Jessica Zeldin on behalf of plaintiff below, Mr. Gerber. I rise to do a number of introductions this morning. With me at council table is Jeffrey Squire and Lawrence Eagle. Mr. Squire will be making today's argument on behalf of the plaintiff below.
Welcome to the court.
Your Honor, very briefly, may I don't have a lengthy introduction. I just wanted to say that everyone at our table is a member of the Delaware Bar, with the exception of Mr. Carl Stern from Vincent Elkins, who has argued before the court in this matter previously.
Welcome.
May it please the court. This afternoon, I would like to discuss three matters: where the Court of Chancery was incorrect, where the Court of Chancery was correct, and where the Court of Chancery was correct, but I don't believe for the correct reason. To repeat these in slightly greater detail, the Court of Chancery's dismissal of the complaint under Section 710B of the Partnership Agreement was incorrect for three reasons. As to the second point, the court was correct in its holding that the pleading alleged sufficient facts to infer bad faith. And when I discuss the facts, I'd like to also discuss the legal standard, which here is breach of contractual duties. And lastly, the Court of Chancery was correct in holding that special approval needed to have been performed in good faith. But in reaching that holding, the court relied on the implied covenant, but in fact, the requirement of good faith here comes right from the contract. So before I get to where I believe the Court of Chancery erred, I'm going to briefly discuss the allegations and the legal standard, the factual background. In 2007, Dan Duncan sold the TEPCO GP, which he owned personally, to EPE for $1.1 billion. In 2009, EPE then sold the TEPCO GP to Enterprise for about $100 million, plus the hope of the same cash flow. For this transaction, there was no bargaining whatsoever. The entire merger premium for this 2009 merger went to the limited partners. None went to the general partners. In 2010, EPE merged with Enterprise. All of these companies, by the way, TEPCO, Enterprise, EPE, were all controlled by Mr. Duncan. In the 2010 merger of EPE, there was no attempt there was no valuation given for the multi-hundred dollar derivative claims against Mr. Duncan.
Multi-hundred million dollar.
The Chancery Court correctly held that the complaint alleged facts to support the inference that defendants did not act in good faith. In 2007, in 2009, and in 2010, defendants favored the interests of the controller of all the companies involved, Mr. Duncan, over the interests of EPE. The defendants did not act in the best interests of EPE. As the Chancery Court wrote, the complaint can fairly be read to allege that because the terms of the 2009 sale were so unfair to EPE, the 2009 sale would not be able to meet the second, third, or fourth standard established by Section 7.9A. That's the conflict of interest provision, one of which standards is that it's a transaction fair and reasonable. So the court held that the facts alleged provided the inference and were sufficient to infer that the defendants knew the transaction was not fair. And then the court went on, according to the complaint, Enterprise Products GP, that's the GP of EPE, decided that the 2009 sale benefited its controller. And then the general partner found a way to use one of Section 7.9A's standards to prevent this court or anyone else from reviewing it. This is an allegation that the general partner exercised in bad faith the discretion it had to use special approval to take advantage of the LPA's duty limitations.
Can you explain that to me? How, if one relies on a provision in a contract to exercise whatever authority or power that provision gives them, and it's part of the contract, how can relying upon it and exercising that provision be bad faith?
Because the contract says that every act and determination in 7.9B has to be done in good faith, which means one has to believe it's in the best interest of the partnership. And that includes special approval. In fact, the defendants conceded, both when we were before this court the last time and in the court below, that special approval has to be done in good faith.
So that is linked to your argument that the good faith consideration here is the contractual defined term of good faith in the contract and not the implied covenant of good
Absolutely,
faith.
Absolutely, Your Honor. Yes. For relying on 7.9B, we don't think that we need to get into the implied covenant of good faith. This is covered by the contract. 7.9B requires all acts and all determinations to be in good faith, except where, as a member of the court has written, where it expressly and unequivocally says otherwise. And in four instances, this contract does. It says that the general partner need not do these certain things in good faith. And apropos of the argument this morning, one of those things in this contract is, says the general partner need not consent to a merger, whether or not in good faith. But special approval is governed by 7.9B and the general requirement that all acts be done in good faith. And I'll just add one more quote regarding the 2009 merger, because this is from a different vice chancellor in the TEPCO case in 2010. Duncan and senior executives decided a merger would be a good idea after the plaintiffs showed the strength of their claims in the derivative action. The record convinces me that the goal of extinguishing plaintiff standing to pursue the derivative action was a primary reason for pursuing the merger. This is the 2009 merger. And similarly, the Chancery Court here held, regarding the 2010 merger, the complaint alleges facts from which the court may infer that a principal purpose of the 2010 merger was the attempted termination of the 2007 and 2009 derivative claims. So a principal purpose of both of these mergers was to benefit the controller, Dan Duncan, not for the benefit of EPE. And both transactions grossly undervalued the consideration paid to EPE in the 2009 merger and in eliminating the derivative claims in the 2010 merger. Now, this undervaluation does really happen, because we can look at the TEPCO case, where after discovery it came out the following. In the TEPCO case, TEPCO sold an asset to Enterprise, and it had a committee and an opinion by Merrill Lynch that the $38 million price was fair. And then in discovery, the plaintiff got the valuation prepared by the banker for the buyer, Enterprise. And it showed a valuation, instead of $38 million, of $780 million, 20 times the price that was paid for the asset. And these involve many of the same companies, many of the same people. So these kinds of things, this is not a theoretical thing, these kinds of things really happen. So that's what I have to say about the background facts. As to the legal duty, I have explained that that comes from 7.9B of the partnership agreement, which says that all acts, except where another standard, specific standard, express standard applies, must be done in good faith. And the Court of Chancery, in two recent cases, Encore and El Paso was about 2.5 weeks ago before the Chancellor, we sent the transcript in. The courts there relied on 7.9B of similar partnership agreements, not exactly the same, but they had that provision, to say that the acts had to be done in good faith. So the question is, what does good faith mean? And here, good faith is defined in the partnership agreement. Good faith is defined as acts in the best interest of the partnership agreement. And that's specific in this partnership agreement as to all acts, except where it says otherwise. So in conclusion, 7.9B requires all acts, including special approval, to be performed in good faith. So we need not get into the implied covenant or a default fiduciary duty. The complaint alleges facts in which it can readily be inferred that the defendants failed to act in good faith. They failed to act in the best interest of the partnership. They were acting in the best interest of the controller, Mr. Duncan. Then I'm now going to turn to what I said was the error that I believe was committed by the Chancery Court, and that's the reliance on the exculpation provision of 7.10B, and I believe the court below erred for three reasons. The Chancery Court dismissed the allegations of bad faith because it believed there was a conclusive presumption in 7.10B of good faith. But three reasons why that was wrong. 7.10B requires reliance on the expert. It doesn't say that if the general partner has an opinion that's enough. The general partner wrote into the contract that it had to rely on the opinion. And that reliance under 7.9b, the good faith provision, must be in good faith. The defendants can't know the opinion is incorrect and then rely on it in good faith. It's not possible. And finally, the chancellor in the El Paso case about 2.5 weeks ago said 7.10b doesn't apply to a conflict situation where the general partner sets up a special committee. And I first thought that was not right, but I'll explain why the chancellor changed my mind. And I believe it is correct that 7.10b does not apply to situations such as those here. So going back to the first of the reasons why 7.10b, then the conclusive presumption, or it's entitled Other Matters Concerning the General Partner, why that doesn't apply is because it requires reliance. And the Chancery Court did not analyze the issue of reliance. And the second point is, not only must there be reliance, but the reliance must be in good faith. There was no analysis of that in the opinion below. What the court said, which I read earlier, was that the general partner decided it couldn't meet any of the other requirements for a conflict transaction under 7.9A, including that the transaction was fair. Then it goes out and gets an opinion that the transaction is fair. It had already concluded otherwise. The general partner and the special committee could not have relied on an opinion which was exactly opposite to the conclusion they had reached. And the Chancery Court doesn't analyze the issue of reliance or how good faith fits in reliance.
So the matter should be remanded for that analysis?
No, I don't think it has to be. The Chancery Court has already found that the complaint alleges sufficient facts to show that the defendants determined the transaction was not fair. And I think, therefore, 7.10b can't apply under those circumstances. I don't think it's possible to show how one reached the conclusion that the transaction was unfair and then rely on an opinion that says it is fair. It doesn't make sense to me. Okay. But then, also, the last time I was here, I was asked whether the good faith requirement for reliance on an expert is in the statute. And that, I didn't know that then, but it is in the statute. DRUPLA 17.407C says a general partner of a limited partnership shall be fully protected from liability in relying in good faith upon an expert opinion. And 7.9B of this partnership agreement puts that good faith requirement across the board, including into reliance on experts. Now, I'm getting to my last point, the third point on Section 7.10B, where the Chancery Court says it doesn't apply. The analysis is this. 7.9A governs conflicts of interest. That has the how conflicts of interest can be handled. 7.10B refers to other matters concerning the general partner. And what we have here is that the general partner sets up a special committee to separate itself. But then, under the terms of the partnership agreement, the opinion here was not given to the general partner. It was only given to the special committee, and 7.10b only refers to opinions given to the general partner. Similarly, 7.10b refers only to the general partner, but the Court of Chancery applied the conclusive, believed, I think, the conclusive presumption could apply to affiliates. But the general partner didn't put the word affiliates into 7.10b. Also, going a little too fast here, in the prospectus, which was looked at the last time, there's a discussion in the prospectus of how conflicts of interest should be handled. And it says either have to be fair and reasonable, or no less than a third party would pay, or special approval. But it doesn't say anything in the prospectus about conflicts being handled by the opinion of an expert. So here, under normal, maybe under fiduciary concepts, one would expand the provisions to say, well, the opinions to the committee and it was acting like the general partner, or one could say the opinion isn't to the general partner, but the general partner should be able to rely on it through the committee. But what we're doing there is rewriting the contract to benefit the general partner. If the general partner wanted opinions given to a special committee to provide for a conclusive presumption of good faith, it could have put that into the partnership agreement. If the general partner wanted affiliates of the general partner to be able to rely on those opinions, it could have put that into the partnership agreement, but it didn't. And we shouldn't rewrite the contract to favor the general partner. I think I've now discussed Section 7.10 10B, and for the three reasons why it doesn't apply, it requires reliance, it requires reliance in good faith, and it doesn't apply to conflict situations. That's why Section 7.10B is entitled Other Matters Concerning the General Partner. So then, this brings me to my last point, where the Chancery Court held that special approval requires good faith, and recall the last time the attorney for the defendants who argued conceded that special approval required good faith, and the Chancery Court said the good faith requirement came from the implied covenant, but I don't believe that that's just correct. I believe we don't have to turn to the implied covenant. We don't have to turn to fiduciary duties. This case can be decided under the contract, and the contract under 7.9B requires that all acts, except for another standards given, and there are four instances of that, all acts, including special approval, need to be done in good faith. So I think the Chancery Court erred in dismissing the individual defendants under the special approval provision because the Chancery Court said, well, it's the contractual duty of good faith that only applies to parties to the contract, and it doesn't apply to the general partner's affiliates. And I believe the Chancery Court erred when it dismissed the complaint under 7.10B because there could not have been reliance in good faith, even assuming the section applies. And I believe a careful analysis of the provisions of the contract shows that it does not apply. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice Steele. Good afternoon, Your Honors. I want to speak first as an introductory matter about the framework of the dispute that we have today. We have all, I think this includes all of us, have grown up, so to speak, in the world of corporations. That's where we cut our teeth in this profession with respect to business disputes. And in the world of corporations, as Your Honors know all too well, all directors are fiduciaries. No corporation could ever purport to eliminate fiduciary duties. It just couldn't happen. Directors owe duties of care, loyalty, and good faith as a component thereof. We know that more than 90% of public transactions are challenged in the Court of Chancery, typically. The lawsuits claim that the directors breached their fiduciary duties. Inevitably, those claims are based on claims that the transaction was unfair. The court below applies in those types of situations a number of standards, the business judgment rule, the entire fairness rule, Unical, Revlon, Blasius, a number of standards are applied. Alternative entities, I would submit, and I believe this is very important for the issues before the court today, use a very different framework. They often eliminate fiduciary duties. They're empowered to do so by our statute. They often, in their operating agreements, address conflicts, supplanting the entire fairness standard. And in this agreement, and it's not atypical, if a majority of independent directors approve a transaction, a conflict transaction, and if, as in the situation at bar, they rely on a banker they reasonably believe to be qualified, the transaction is deemed approved by all partners. That is a very different mechanic than we have in the corporate setting. These partnerships, in essence, opt out of the investor litigation that occupies every single day in the Court of Chancery. They opt out of these litigations challenging the economic fairness of deals. And Delaware law respects their right to do so. It's in the statute. We will respect their freedom of contract, their ability to opt out of those types of lawsuits. So now, as we move to this particular agreement, I'd like to speak first briefly about the conflict resolution provisions in the agreement and then turn to the plaintiff's contentions. 7.9a sets forth four ways to deal with conflicts, one of which is special approval. Special approval is defined as follows. Special approval means approval by a majority of the members of the Audit and Conflicts Committee. That's at page A8. That happened here. That approval occurred. There's no allegation that it didn't happen, nor could there be. Now, the members of the Audit and Conflicts Committee must be independent, and that's defined as people who meet the independence requirements of the SEC. and the New York Stock Exchange. There is no challenge on this appeal, not one, to the finding of the trial court that the complaint did not contain allegations sufficient to call into question the independence of the members of the ACG. So we have uncontested facts here, cannot be contested. The ACG was properly constituted, and it approved the transactions. Now we look into the partnership agreement, which tells us that an action that receives special approval is deemed approved by all partners and is not a breach of the agreement or any duty stated by law or equity. In this area of alternative entities, Delaware law recognizes and promotes the freedom of contract. That policy, I would submit, Your Honors, leads to affirming the court below.
Mr. Williams, your friend on the other side said, if I understood him correctly, that it was conceded that the special approval process under the agreement must be carried out in good faith. Is that an accurate statement?
That's not accurate, Your Honor.
It doesn't have to be carried out in good faith.
Let me explain that. It is not subject to 7.9B's good faith requirement, because 7.9B says you can supplant 7.9B with another standard of the agreement, and we believe 7.9A does that. With respect to the good faith question that you ask, one might interpret that to mean, well, what about the implied covenant?
No, I'm just asking.
The contractual good faith?
I'm asking whether under the contract, if the special approval process is used as the cleansing mechanism, that it has to be carried out in good faith, as that term is defined by the contract.
Defined in 7.9B, which is where it's defined, we would say the answer to that is no. You don't have to agree with me because it's supplanted by 7.9A. I really want to emphasize this. You don't have to agree with me, Your Honor, to affirm, because as we'll talk about, the allegations of this complaint do not create inferences, reasonable inferences of bad faith, even if bad faith was required, or I'm sorry, even if special approval needed to occur in good faith. So either way, you can affirm, but under our view of the agreement, 7.9A supplants the good faith of 7.9B.
And 7.9A's standard is what?
7.9A's standard is, if you follow special approval, if you get approval by independent directors, all duties in this agreement are satisfied. It is deemed approved by all investors.
Whether or not it's carried out in good faith.
Whether or not it's carried out in compliance with 7.9B, because 7.9B says it is subject to being, in effect, supplanted by another standard in the agreement. But I also do want to...
Go ahead, Your Honor. In the prospectus, when the unit holders bought their, purchased their interest, were they told that this process would not be subject to a good faith requirement?
Your Honor, what the prospectus says is that the agreement modifies and restricts fiduciary duties. It doesn't say it eliminates. I don't think there's an express statement that good faith doesn't constrain special approval, but I would say this.
It doesn't say that.
I don't believe it does say that, no.
So, one of the reasonable expectations of a purchaser of these units is that good faith would constrain the process?
Your Honor, I would say when you look at 7.9A, which says if you get special approval, it's deemed approved by all stockholders, that good faith doesn't. I wouldn't think that necessarily would be constrained by good faith. I do want to speak to...
But you're talking about something that's non-responsive to the question.
Well, you asked me, don't I think that an investor would believe
maybe,
that good faith...
Maybe an investor would say, well, yes, that's fine. If there is good faith in carrying out this special approval process, then it makes sense that it would be deemed approved by all the unit holders. But it doesn't go to the question of whether good faith is, a foundational requirement of the process, or what the investors were told at the time that they purchased their units on the public securities market.
And Your Honor, at the end of the day, this is not a disclosure case. That claim is not made by the plaintiffs. It's interpretation of the agreement. And we would submit that the terms of the agreement are clear.
But the reasonable expectations of investors are to be taken into account in determining what that means, doesn't it?
Your Honor, I think in interpreting the agreement, you don't have to look to the reasonable expectations of investors where the agreement's clear, and we submit it is. We think that's fundamental Delaware contract law.
You're telling me that you don't have to tell the investor that you can have a contract that doesn't require this clinching mechanism to be carried out in good faith, but you don't have to tell the investors that?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think whether or not the disclosures were, as Your Honor would have them back when this partnership was formed, does decide the question today, because the ability of this court and the lower court to decide the question depends upon interpretation of the agreement. That's what controls today. And I believe the agreement is clear. And let me just say one thing about good faith constraining special approval. Mr. Squire is counsel in the El Paso case. He submitted the transcript a week or so ago. I don't know if Your Honors want to rely upon that transcript ruling, but let me just say this. That agreement had a very different provision. Mr. Squire said something to the effect in his opening that the agreements were substantially similar or something like that. In fact, they're very different. In that agreement, as reflected in the transcript that he submitted up to you, the definition of special approval is as follows, and I'm quoting from page 33 of the transcript. Mr. Squire tells the Chancellor, special approval in this partnership agreement at page 22 says particularly, special approval has to be in good faith. And that partnership agreement then gives the members of the ACG a rebuttable presumption of good faith, but it in essence invites unit holders represented by folks like Mr. Squire to come in and try and rebut that presumption. We don't have that language in this agreement. Special approval is not defined in that way. It's defined very clearly, I would submit. So, Your Honor, but I do want to emphasize that even if you think good faith constrains the process, you can affirm, because there is nothing in this complaint from which one could reasonably conclude that these directors acted in subjective bad faith or reasonable bad faith. However you want to qualify bad faith, there's nothing in this complaint that I submit can get you there.
Now, one of the things I think I heard in the earlier argument, to your point just made, is they knew going into the special approval process that the terms of the transaction were unfair. Therefore, it's just obviously in bad faith to accept the clothing of a conclusive presumption when you know that the transaction was unfair. Why do you say there's nothing alleged in the complaint to suggest that they knew that the transaction was unfair, or the factual basis on which they knew or should have known it was unfair?
Your Honor, I would submit there is nothing well pled in that complaint that says, nor could there be, that these admittedly independent directors knew that this was an unfair transaction and somehow duped Morgan Stanley into opining that it is fair. There's nothing in the complaint other than sheer conclusion upon which you could draw that reference. It just isn't there.
Morgan Stanley didn't take into account the value or the claim value of the 2007-09 derivative claims, which are alleged to be in the hundreds of millions of dollars.
Your Honor,
is that right?
Well, that's with respect to now. We have two transactions at issue.
Well, I thought we were talking about the merger.
Well, we've been talking generally, I would say. The 2009 transaction involves what's challenged here, the sale of TEPCO GP. The 2010 transaction is the merger.
Right, which I believe the Vice Chancellor Noble held, whose principal purpose was the termination of the 2007-2009 claims.
Your Honor, he said there was an inference you could draw from the complaint in that regard, and I'd love to address that specifically, because
I think he said more than there's an inference, but you say, yeah, I think you could say that he held that the complaint does allege that.
Let's dilate on that if we could. Here's where we submit in that regard, the Court of Chancery got it wrong. He said he drew an inference, he said, from the terms of...
From that, did you?
Beg your pardon?
You didn't cross appeal from that.
Didn't cross appeal. I don't believe we needed to. It doesn't expand our rights on appeal, so I don't think we did need to cross appeal. But what he says is, I draw an inference from the complaint that EPE had no interest whatsoever in a merger with Enterprise. And here are the allegations that he draws that merger from, or that inference from. He draws those, that inference from the allegations in the complaint that Enterprise bid once. It was rejected as inadequate by the special committee. They bid twice, rejected it as inadequate again. They bid against themselves a third time. And at that point, the ACG of EPE started to interact with them with respect to a potential transaction. That's not showing no interest at all in a merger. That's effective negotiation. And so where the lower court was going was, his reading of the complaint was, there was no interest at all in this merger, and then they met with their advisors, and their advisors discussed with them, the complaint concedes, that the ACG met with its advisors, me specifically, personally, and Baker Hostetler, and we discussed with them the derivative claims.
Is there any other portion or aspect of the Vice Chancellor's opinion that in your side's view is wrong besides this one?
But Your Honor, can I finish very briefly on that first one and then get to the next one? He draws the conclusion, the inference, that because the ACG met with its advisors and received advice from them with respect to these derivative claims, and then they bid, that they must have only bid because of the advice they received about the derivative claims. I submit that's not a reasonable inference with respect to a committee that is causing the other side to bid against itself. Your Honor, there is another inference in the complaint or in the opinion that we think is incorrect. We don't think it stands to reason that the GP acts in bad faith because it elects to use special approval, which is one of the methods available for it to cleanse a conflict transaction. We think that's an unreasonable inference.
Did the court find that?
The court drew an inference that the complaint made allegations from which he didn't find it, but from which one could infer that the GP acted in bad faith in choosing to go down the special approval route. But we think there is really no basis for that, because just remember one thing. No one determines to be bound by special approval until after you have a committee formed, the committee gets advice from its banker, and the committee acts. The delegation of a matter to a committee, even if there was some scrutiny that could be attached to that delegation, that's not a defining moment in this transaction.
This case comes up on a motion to dismiss a complaint, doesn't it?
Yes, sir.
So we're not engaged in weighing evidence or fact-finding?
We're not. But only reasonable inferences need be drawn from the complaint, and they must be drawn on well-pled facts. That survives Central Mortgage. And Your Honor, I would really love to, if we could, go to these allegations that they make about this 2009 merger. The 2010 merger, the only challenge is these derivative claims. And let me also say on the derivative claims, it's important to understand one set, there are two sets of derivative claims. One set was filed in 2008. The merger occurred in 2010. Those claims had never advanced. They were subject to a motion to dismiss at the time of the merger. They have not advanced to this day. The complaint was amended, and there was a September motion to dismiss in this year, argued in the Court of Chancery. The second set of claims that they claim give rise to a conclusion that somehow these directors acted in bad faith were claims that hadn't even been asserted. They were threatened. They were threatened claims. They hadn't even been asserted. And those are the claims that eventually were dismissed by the court below. And as I say, those claims were discussed and is conceded in the complaint by the committee's advisors, including me and my partner Srini Raju and Baker Hostetler. So, Your Honor, going to now what they say about this transaction, the 2009 transaction. They don't ever say in the complaint, and I think this is extremely important, they don't ever say, contrary to what they said today, that there was no reliance on the Morgan Stanley opinion. That's not in the complaint. You won't find it. And I would encourage Your Honors to look very carefully at this complaint. There are lots of descriptions of it that are floating around that aren't necessarily accurate. In the complaint, here's what they say about reliance on the banker's opinion. Page 22. Defendants could not have reasonably relied in good faith on the opinion of Morgan Stanley. 23. Further, the materials Morgan Stanley presented with its opinion showed that its opinion was obviously and materially flawed, and no member of the ACG committee and no loyal director could have relied on that opinion fairly and in good faith. They don't say they didn't rely. They criticize the reliance. There's not an allegation that no one relied. They criticize the reliance. And with respect to whether or not reliance is subject to a good faith requirement, we submit that it's not. 710B is very clear. It says you must rely, and it says you must reasonably believe that the advisor that you're relying upon is competent in this area. And there's no way that they could claim that Morgan Stanley wasn't competent. And so I would also point out to the court with respect to this issue of did reliance have to be in good faith. The statute, 17404, I believe it is, says, I'm sorry, 407B, says that directors, or I'm sorry, general partners can rely in good faith, they can rely in good faith on opinions they believe, from advisors they believe, to reasonably believe to be qualified. That's in the statute. Of course, we know the statute can be altered by agreement. This agreement deletes that good faith concept. It's taken out. They took part of what's in 17407B. They took out the rest. So we submit there is nothing in this agreement that justifies this reading of good faith into the word reliance. And now let's look at what they say was so bad.
Can I stop you there? I'm having some conceptual problems. Let's say the committee hires Morgan Stanley, and everybody knows that Morgan Stanley meets the qualifications. But the person who comes and makes the presentation says, I just want you to know that we've reached an opinion that this is a fair transaction. But in order to do that, we had to, you know, eliminate half the assets here and give them no value. So just so you know, we got you a good number, but we did it basically in a way that's fraudulent. And if that were to happen, which we all know would never happen, but if that were to happen, are you saying that that would be fine? The committee can rely on that, knowing that it's Morgan Stanley, so it's an okay provider of the opinion, but B, we also know that opinion is false.
I'm not saying that at all, Your Honor. In that hypothetical, which I agree really doesn't happen, I don't see how you could in fact, on an opinion that someone has told you is not reliable. I don't see how you could as a factual matter.
Okay, so, and I kind of assumed that might be the answer, and doesn't that get then to the question of, well, how bad does it have to be before you say you can't rely on it? And isn't that what the allegations are trying to drive at?
Your Honor, they try to get there. They fall well short of that. And let me also say that in a situation like that, that's fraud. That's somewhere. That's a situation where I believe the implied covenant would come into play. In this particular complaint, with respect to this complaint, the implied covenant has no application because they've not identified any gaps or holes or unforeseen circumstances. This was all foreseen, that a special committee would be created and that the ACG would rely upon a banker, all foreseen to resolve a conflict. So, but you have to really look at this complaint, because what they have, it's nothing different than the typical complaints we see in Chancery. The banker's opinion was flawed, and therefore you must, in fact, find these directors acted disloyally, or in this case, they're saying bad faith. But look at what they say. One set of allegations. The directors must have known, and remember, bad faith means they believed they were acting not in the interest of the partnership, contrary to the interest of the partnership. They believed that. They must have believed they were acting contrary to the interest of the partnership because Morgan Stanley didn't include a comparable transactions analysis. I submit that that's ridiculous. Bankers use different analyses for different situations. And Credit Suisse, which opined to the TEPCO investors and which they laud in their papers as having done a wonderful job, according to the opinion, Credit Suisse didn't look at comparable transactions either. So that's one thing that they say gives rise to an inference that these independent people affirmatively acted in a way that they knew to be contrary to the interests of the partnership. And the second thing, they say, well, wait a minute. You relied upon an opinion that looked at these two transactions, opined as to these two transactions, the sale of the TEPCO LP units and the sale of the TEPCO GP collectively. EPE owns TEPCO LP units, limited partnership units. It also owned the GP. Morgan Stanley looked at them both together. The transactions were intertwined. They were required. Both had to occur for either to occur. And Morgan Stanley opined collectively as to the two transactions. Could someone have asked Morgan Stanley, or could Morgan Stanley have written something differently? I'm sure they could have. But can you possibly come to an inference that these independent people acted in subjective bad faith because of that? It's impossible, I would submit. And then the final thing that they really emphasize, and this really draws a lot of attention to them, they say in Morgan Stanley's book, which supports its fairness opinion, Morgan Stanley is opining that the transaction is fair, it has these underlying values of the TEPCO GP at $705 million and $687 million, and that those numbers are far greater than the compensation that was received for TEPCO GP in the merger. That they kind of act like is sort of their smoking gun. Well, the complaint itself recognizes that the value of a general partner is directly tied to its right to receive cash distributions. Before this transaction, EPE owned the cash distributions from the TEPCO GP and the cash distributions from the Enterprise GP. Those two entities were being merged together, so after this is all done, EPE will own the cash distributions from both of those two entities. It is a cash flow neutral transaction, and the plaintiffs admit that in their complaint. They say in paragraph 51D, the transaction would be cash flow neutral. So the underlying valuations have no applicability when you have a transaction where the value of the GP, the cash flows, will be retained after the transaction. That, I would submit, is a red herring. Your Honor, I see my time is up. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I apologize. When I was up here before, I couldn't find the reference to where I believe that the defendants had conceded in this court and conceded in the court below that special approval had to be done in good faith. From the transcript, from the recording of the transcript, I believe the court asked the following question last time. Were they required to perform the special approval process in good faith to the attorney for defendants? Is the answer yes or no? It's yes. Question, yes. Answer, yes. And then in the lower court opinion, I'm reading from transcript page 10 to 12, I have the definitions of the court in here, and special approval is approval by the Audit and Conflicts Committee. And I'm skipping to page 12, and they can do the most sweetheart deal in the world for my benefit. Is that your position? And the attorney for the defendant said, Your Honor, I think there has to be some standard governing the ACC's approval. I believe that is good faith. I believe that if you can show that subjectively, the plaintiffs can show that subjectively these best friends acted arbitrarily or in bad faith, in other words, in a matter that they had affirmatively did not reasonably believe to be in the best interest of the limited partnership, then no, they can't do that.
Is that the transcript from the prior oral argument or in the Court of Chancery?
That's the transcript from the Court of Chancery. Okay. What I read first was what we took from the recording of the transcript before this court. So I think that was conceded. I think also that what the defendants are really arguing for here is an implied right to act in bad faith. It doesn't say that they can take special approval in bad faith, but they say, well, it can be implied from the fact that we don't say any specific standard in section 7.9A. But I don't think that can be done as I read Delaware law and what members of this court have written, that under the contract, good faith can be eliminated, but it has to be done expressly and unequivocally, like it's done in four instances in the partnership agreement, such as where the general partner acts in its own personal interest rather than as a general partner.
Can I ask you to counter, if you can, the comments that were just made about how there's nothing in this complaint to even raise an inference of bad faith, that the complaints about what Morgan Stanley didn't do, like having a comparative company analysis, clearly is not sufficient to suggest bad faith. What have you got, you know, give me numbers of
sure.
parts of your complaint
okay.
that you say create the bad faith.
Well, I'll try to give you the references, but I can give you the allegations are that this was done first to benefit the controller of the companies. It was not done to benefit EPE. The Tansbury Court understood the defendant's argument that this was just a merger, and the hope would be that the merger of two cash flows would produce the same cash flow. But there's always risk in a merger. The Tansbury Court recognized that they might have the same cash flow, but they might not. And investors are compensated for that risk in every case. There's no merger of a general partner that I'm aware of, and I'm pretty sure I know what they are, where the general partner did not receive a premium in connection with the merger. There were no comparables in the Morgan Stanley report and no explanation for the lack of comparables, because any comparable would have showed that the general owners of the general partner are paid a premium in these kinds of mergers, even when it's a combination of the same cash flow, because many of these mergers are where the limited partners buy out the general partner. So they're all going to exist on the same cash flow, but the general partners in every case get a premium. There was no bargaining here. What happened was there was bargaining on behalf of the limited partners. We were involved with the limited partners back then, and there was heavy bargaining. In fact, the limited partners rejected exactly this offer, the offer that the limited partners would get the same cash flow, and that's in the Brinkerhoff versus TEPCO decision.
But again, I'm having a problem with, you know, there may be all kinds of things that they should have done, and they should have been aggressive and negotiated and what have you. But the absence of those things doesn't equate to bad faith, does it?
Well, I believe that when the general partner of the general partner, the committee for the general partner, doesn't try to bargain at all, just accepts a plug-in number. That's all that was done here. Once the terms of the limited partnership merger were determined, all that happened was the general partner, the EPE's ownership of the general partner of TEPCO, all EPE got was a plug-in number that would hopefully give it the same cash flow. There was no attempt to get any premium. There was a premium, about a 15% premium paid to the limited partners because they bargained. But the entire premium for the merger went to the general partner, went to the limited partners, and none of that premium went to the general partner. I don't see how people acting in the best interest of the partnership could just lay down and say, well, when the limited partners are through, you give us a plug-in number and we'll sign off on that. And that's exactly what happened here. So I think the complaint, and I think the Chancery Court correctly held that the complaint did allege sufficient facts, which it can be inferred that the transaction was done not in good faith.
And you will provide me with some numbers from the complaint?
Sure.
It doesn't have to be right this minute.
All right, we can. With regard to reliance on the banker's opinion, again, I don't believe that was correct about the limited partners banker's opinion. I believe it did have comparable transactions. Virtually every banker's opinion, a fairness opinion that I've seen that has a book that goes with it, has comparable companies, discounted cash flow, and comparable transactions. And this one, without explanation, has no comparable transactions because one could not look at any comparable transaction without seeing that a premium was paid. And here, there was no premium paid. All they got was the hope, as the Chancery Court recognized. All that EPE got for the TEPCO GP was the hope of the same cash flow and nothing more. And that's not a reason for the transaction to be done in the best interest of EPE. This transaction, the 2009 merger, was done to, as both this court held and the court held in Brinkerhoff versus TEPCO, was done to try to eliminate derivative claims against the controller, Mr. Duncan. Going back to special approval just for 1 minute, I don't think, a number of courts have addressed this, and no court has held that special approval is not constrained by good faith. In the El Paso agreement, it was specific. It did say special approval means approval in good faith. But this is silent on the matter, which means special approval is an act. It's not a mental state. It's an act, and it's a determination, and it's governed by Section 7.9B, which requires that all acts, except where specifically stated otherwise, expressly stated otherwise, must be in good faith. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement. We'll assess.
Aye.